You're listening to episode 13 of the Synchronicity Podcast. Today's text is John 11. Hello, everybody, and welcome again to another edition of the Synchronicity Podcast. Our email address is synchronicity.podcast@gmail.com. We are on Twitter at SyncPod, that's SyncPod. And our web address is synchronicitypodcast.com. This is the last episode that we're going to be posting on Podomatic, which means that if you've been subscribing to our podcast over Podomatic or just wandering over and listening to us on Podomatic, we're not going to be available there anymore. You may also need to make some changes if you're an iTunes subscriber, and I'll get to that in a minute. But first of all, for those of you who are on Podomatic, in order to continue to listen to our podcasts after this episode, you're going to need to go to our website, synchronicitypodcast.com. You can hear all of the episodes from there straight off the website if you want to, and if you have a pod catcher or a feed reader, you can also subscribe to an RSS feed where you'll be updated when new podcasts become available. And depending on which feed reader you use, Google Reader, for example, I know, and I think Bloglines as well, have built-in players so that you can actually listen from your feed reader if you want to. But if you're listening to us over Podomatic, you're going to need to go over and start using the website or one of the feeds off of the website to continue to hear the podcast. Now, for those of you who are iTunes subscribers, you need to be aware that there are two iTunes podcasts right now that this particular podcast feed appears on. One of them is a podcast that is tied into Podomatic, and that podcast is about to end. You won't any longer be able to get subscriptions off of that one. But there is a second podcast that's already up and it's active there that will continue to have the episodes fed into iTunes through that feed. So all you'll need to do, if you're subscribing to us via iTunes, is just make sure that you have the newer podcast, the newer feed. And the best way to tell whether you have got the newer podcast or not is just go in and look at the feed for the current podcast that you're subscribed to. If the last three or four episodes have descriptions of the content of those episodes in them, then that's an indication that you are subscribed to the correct feed on iTunes. If you go in there and you look at it and you see that instead of episode descriptions, you have an indication that we've moved from the Podomatic side and that we're about to start podcasting from the synchronicity.podcom, synchronicitypodcast.com site, then what you'll need to do is cancel the subscription that you currently have and then relink to the subscription that includes episode content for the last three or four episodes. Alternatively, another way to do this, if you just want to be safe or if you're just confused by what I just described to you, is you can go into iTunes and then just cancel your iTunes feed as it currently exists. Then go to the website, synchronicitypodcast.com, and subscribe to the iTunes feed that's linked on the website, because that will be the correct feed. But one way or the other, if you're an iTunes user, you'll need to make sure that you're tied into the correct Synchronicity podcast feed. I'm also going to follow this up with one last smaller announcement that will only go on the Podomatic side of things, that will give similar instructions to what you're getting here. So if you've missed this, you'll get one more chance, particularly if you subscribe over iTunes. Okay, well, let's get started with today's episode by counting signs in the Gospel of John. So let's get started by counting signs today in the Gospel of John. You may recall at the end of the last episode, I suggested it might be an interesting exercise for you to go through the Gospel of John and count all of the signs that Jesus performs, these miracles that he performs leading up to the resurrection of Lazarus. So let's get started in John chapter 2. This is the wedding feast at Cana. Jesus turns water into wine. Very famous story. And in verse 11 it says, Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee and revealed his glory. Then skipping over to chapter 4, we have Jesus encountering a royal official whose son is ill. He tells the official to go home and his son will live. Sure enough, the son does live. And then it says in verse 54 of chapter 4, now this was the second sign that Jesus did after coming from Judea to Galilee. Now he stops numbering his signs after this, but I think it's still pretty clear when signs are being performed. Then at the beginning of chapter 5, we have Jesus healing this man who is lame, who lays beside the pool, and this happens on the Sabbath. It stirs things up quite a bit, and there's no indication here that this is the third sign, but it clearly is yet another one of these signs because it's something extraordinary. It's not something that just anyone could do. So there is sign number 3. Then, chapter 6, Jesus feeds 5,000 people with only a very small amount of bread and fish. And there's quite a bit of discussion about this that follows in chapter 6. That's clearly the fourth sign. Immediately following that story in verse 16, there's a story about Jesus walking on the water. There is your fifth sign. Then you have to skip a little ways through the text to get to chapter 9. And in chapter 9, at the beginning of the chapter, Jesus heals a man who is blind. And there is your sixth sign, so that when you finally come around to chapter 11 and you have the raising of Lazarus, what you have is a seventh sign. There'll be one more sign to follow this, and this will be the resurrection of Jesus himself. Now, it's been suggested, and I think this is a pretty reasonable perspective, that if this is a story about God's new creation, about God initiating and bringing into the world this new creation that's going to burst forth, that's going to rectify all of the things that are wrong, all of the evils that are in the world, then what we may have here in these first seven signs are acts of new creation, acts that are bringing into existence new creation, whether it's giving sight or healing the lame or feeding people or ultimately raising the dead. These are all acts or signs of what this new creation is supposed to be about. And that those would parallel the first 7 days, the 7 days in which God created the earth, such that when Jesus is raised from the dead, that's the eighth day, that would be Monday, that's a signal that that is the first day in which God's new order, his new creation, his new kingdom is going to burst forth into the world. So we'll come back and take a much closer look at this seventh sign, the raising of Lazarus, right after the break. John chapter 11 and verse 1 tells us that a certain man was ill. His name is Lazarus of Bethany. Bethany, by the way, was thought to possibly be kind of a colony or a city that was located just outside of Jerusalem where people who were ill, where they might go to receive treatment. And so Lazarus is in this village called Bethany. It's also a village where Mary and her sister Martha, these two women that will play such a pivotal role in this story from here on out, where they live. In fact, it jumps ahead a little bit. It jumps into chapter 12 just to let us know that Mary is the one who is later going to anoint Jesus with perfume and wipe his feet with her hair. So it's her brother, it's Lazarus, who is ill. And because he's fallen ill, the sisters send a message to Jesus. And the message is, Lord, he whom you love is ill. Now, at this time, Jesus is apparently nowhere near Jerusalem or Bethany. If you recall, in chapters 9 and 10, we had this incident where Jesus healed this man who had been blind from birth. And there was an effort on the part of the Judeans, the leaders who lived in this region of the country, to try to discredit it by getting this man to state, by intimidating him really into stating that Jesus is a sinner. But rather than doing that, this man called them on the carpet, and they began to get an idea because of the way that this man rebuked them about how the crowds might begin to follow Jesus as they begin to have more and more faith in the signs that he's been doing. And so they resolve themselves that they're going to stone Jesus, and that's a means of execution. And Jesus escapes them and then leaves the region. And so he's far away now from Jerusalem, far away from Bethany, where Lazarus has become ill. And they send a message to him that says, Lazarus is ill. And when Jesus hears this message, he says this illness does not lead to death. One of the very interesting features of this story is that Jesus appears to know what the end of the story is going to be from the very beginning. That's going to create a real problem that I can't quite puzzle through completely as we get later on in chapter 11. But he says this illness is not going to lead to death. Rather, it is to God's glory, so that the Son of Man may be glorified through it. This clearly fitting the pattern of the seventh of the seven signs here, because it is something that's to give God's glory, for God to be glorified through the things that Jesus is doing. So, it says, even though Jesus loved Mary and her sister, and even though he loved Lazarus, after hearing that Lazarus was ill, he still stayed where he was for 2 days. And then after that, after he'd waited for 2 days, received this news about Lazarus being ill, he waits for 2 days. Then he says, let's go back to Judea. So Jesus is going back now to this place that is very, very dangerous for him to be returning to. And the disciples object to it on that basis. They say, teacher, the Judeans were just now trying to stone you, and you want to go there again? Don't you remember how they tried to kill you the last time we were there? And Jesus says something that is a little mysterious, a little bit cryptic here. He talks about how there are 12 hours of daylight. And if you walk in the day, you don't stumble because you have the light of the world. But if you walk in the night, you're going to stumble because the light is not there. Now, Jesus has already on multiple occasions compared himself to the light, described himself as the light of the world. And what he seems to be saying here is that there's just a very limited amount of time left for me to do my work. The time has almost come for me to be gone. And as he'll say in a moment, I need for you to believe in me. And we'll talk in more detail in a moment about what that means for the disciples to believe in him. And so it's urgent that he continue to press forward, that he even take risks of life and limb by going back to Judea, because there's something that needs to be revealed to these people that are following. There's something that they need to understand. And his actions involving Lazarus are going to relate to that. And he has to do this before it becomes dark, before he's not with them any longer. And there's a risk that they will stumble. They need to have this light, this faith, before he's no longer with them. So, after saying this, he tells them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to awaken him. And then his followers, very typical of John, they don't understand that. They say, Lord, if he's fallen asleep, then he's going to be okay, if that's all that's happened. And Jesus, of course, is using a euphemism here to talk about his death when he says he's fallen asleep. They were thinking he was just referring, it says, to sleep. And so he says to them now, plainly, Lazarus is dead. And then he says, for your sake, I'm glad I wasn't there, because you have to believe. See, then returning to this theme a minute ago about I need to bring you into faith while I, the light, am still with you. So let us now go to him. And then Thomas, one of the disciples, who is called Didymus, which is the twin, he says to everybody else, okay, well, let's go then, that we may die with him. Thomas, always the eternal optimist, yet not necessarily really being painted in a negative light here or later in the book when he'll question whether Jesus really has risen from the dead. Thomas here just saying it's time to go, and yeah, it's going to be Jesus' death, and we may even go with him, but let's go, let's head on. And there's something of an act of faith in that, isn't there? When you're a pessimist and yet you're willing to still continue to press forward because of the influence of the person that you are following. So, in verse 17, we kind of skip through the journey to Bethany, and in verse 17, we see that Jesus has arrived, and when he arrives, Lazarus has been dead and in the tomb, not just dead, but in the tomb for 4 days. Now, and then it tells us Bethany is near Jerusalem, and it's only 2 miles away. And so many of the Judeans had come to Martha and Mary to console them about their brother. This is a very typical tradition from this time, where when people would go into mourning, when there would be a death, then for days and days, people that know them, people that had a relationship with them, they would come and they would be with them and they would offer them comfort during this time of their grief. So we have people from Judea, from Jerusalem, a good number of them apparently, who are there and they are present with Mary and with Martha when Jesus arrives to town. And Martha gets wind that Jesus is coming, and so she goes and she meets him. So Martha runs away from the place where she and the others are located to meet Jesus while he's on the way. And she says to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But if you do the math here, you'll see that there really wasn't a whole lot that could have been done if Jesus had to be physically present for Lazarus to remain alive, because Jesus only delayed his journey for 4 days, but Lazarus was dead for, he only delayed his journey for 2 days, but Lazarus had been dead, we're told in verse 17, for 4 days when he arrives, which means that even if he'd left immediately, he'd already have been 2 days late anyway. But at any rate, Martha says to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And then she says, but even now I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him. So Martha is professing faith in Jesus that he could, in fact, raise Lazarus from the dead, even though he wasn't there when Lazarus died. And then Jesus says to her, your brother will rise again. And in response to that, Martha says, well, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Now, we got to stop here and talk for a moment about what she's talking about here, the resurrection at the last day. A common belief among the people of God during this time, and that would include Mary and Martha and the sect of people who were referred to as the Pharisees that we've encountered before and will encounter again in this text. Their belief was that a day was coming when God would restore the earth, when he would bring his new creation into being. But there was a problem associated with that, because there were all kinds of people who were righteous, who believed in this promise, that had died for centuries, literally, had lived and had died and had never seen that promise, had never had a chance to live it out and to realize it. So there was a belief that when this happened, when God came into kind of this world that was in darkness and that was overshadowed by evil, and he kind of righted all of the wrongs that were in the world, that he would also raise from the dead those who were righteous who had come before. And so when Jesus says in verse 23, your brother will rise again, that's a little cryptic. It's not necessarily a promise that God is going to raise Lazarus kind of right here and right now. Instead, it's not clear exactly when, what the time frame is when it's going to happen. And so when Martha says, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day, what she's saying is she's professing faith that God is ultimately moving us toward this future in which this resurrection will occur. But she's also kind of in a backhanded way saying, but that's not what I want to know. I want to know whether it's something that God can do through you right now. If you ask God to bring Lazarus back from the dead, that he will do that. And so now Jesus says in verse 25 to her, another one of these so-called I am statements. Jesus makes several I am statements, by most people's count, seven again, just like there are seven signs, about himself, about his nature. And by using the words I am when he makes that statement, he's recalling back to the book of Exodus when God describes himself as the great I am. So Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. A profound statement here, because what he is claiming is that this future, this action of God in which he's going to set the world right, in which he's going to take the world out of darkness into light, I am the embodiment of that. I am the very instrument, the very thing that's going to make it possible for that future to be implemented. I am that resurrection. I am that life that returns to people on that day. And so it's important not to focus on so much on that day and on the promise of that day as it is on me and on my character and on my identity. So he follows by saying, if you believe in me, even though you die, you will live. And if you live and believe in me, you'll never die. And he asks her this question again about belief. Remember, he's been talking about the disciples earlier about belief, and now he's going to ask them about, or he's going to ask Martha about belief. Do you believe this? And she says to him, yes, Lord. This is maybe the most profound confession that you find, at least before Jesus' resurrection in this gospel. I believe that you are the Messiah. You are the Christ. You're the one that God promised to send to us, that's coming into the world to bring about this reality. Now, I mentioned a minute ago that I wanted to talk in a little bit more detail about what belief means. Because I think there is a tendency among churchy folks, in America at least, to assume that belief simply means kind of an intellectual acknowledgement. Yes, I will state as a matter of my formal position on who Jesus is that he is the Messiah. And that somehow there's a kind of a magic just in kind of assenting to that fact, where everything else just falls into place. God just kind of instantly does all kinds of magical things to make things right as a result of that. And I don't really think that when John talks about believing in Jesus, that's what he means. And I'll continue to flesh this out as we move along, but for now, let me just say that I think when John talks about believing in Jesus, he means investing in him. He means allowing yourself or coming to see or view the universe, the cosmos, as it really is, coming into and just kind of being immersed in that. And it's more than just an intellectual understanding. It's something that your whole being kind of absorbs and begins to see that God is present and he is in charge, and there's a certain way that he's made the world to be ordered, and it ought to be ordered that way. It's kind of this gestalt, this holistic understanding of God and of what he's doing in the world. And that's what I think Jesus is really wanting people to come to when they believe, not just to kind of intellectually assent that, yeah, you're the guy, and kind of rubber stamp it, but to perceive, to understand, to become immersed in an understanding of what God's new world, of what his reality is like. And so Martha does. She sees that he's the Messiah, that he is the Son that's coming into the world to bring about this reality. All right, now, after Martha makes this confession to Jesus, the text says, she goes back and she calls her sister Mary. And she says to her sister Mary, tries to tell her privately, the teacher is here and he's calling for you. We're not told that in the text, but apparently Jesus says, go get your sister. And so when she hears it, she gets up quickly and goes to him. Now, notice the way there's an effort to kind of do this privately. Jesus apparently calls for Mary, and he makes it clear to Martha that he wants her and only her to come. So there's this private conversation. And Jesus remains outside of town. He doesn't come to this place where these crowds are. He's trying to draw Mary out as kind of Martha came drawn out so that he can speak with her privately. But the Jews who are with her, these Judeans that are with her in the house, they see her get up and she's running out of the house. And they decide, the text tells us, that they think she's in this deep, deep grief. And so they think maybe she's going to the tomb to weep there, and they feel the need to go and to console her. So Mary comes, sure enough, to where Jesus is, and she sees him, and she kneels at his feet, and she says, Lord, the same thing that Martha said, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. And now we get to the part of this text that is a little bit difficult for me. I have a little bit of a feel for it, but having some problems with it too. Maybe some of you will have some insight on this, and you can post a comment in connection with this episode on it. But it talks about Jesus seeing Mary weeping, and then Jesus seeing the Judeans who came with her, and they're also weeping. And it talks about how he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. Now, the words that you see there, greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved, are an accurate translation to an extent. But the problem with this particular translation is that there is a very strong connotation that comes with these words that is a connotation of anger. All right, it's not really a connotation of kind of sentimental sadness, sentimental tears because a dear one has been lost or because you see, you know, you're trying to sympathize with somebody else who's lost someone. There is a kind of an anger and indignation that is in this. And he says, where have you laid him? And they said to him, Lord, come and see. Those words, again, echoing words that Jesus said to his first disciples way back at the beginning of the book. He invited them to come and see. And then it says Jesus began to weep. Very difficult to understand exactly what Jesus' emotions are about here. It's very clear from the text that he knows days before this, many days before this, that Lazarus is going to live, that God is going to give life back to Lazarus. So it certainly can't be for his own loss. And it could possibly be he's upset because now he's going to have to do this thing publicly, and that's just going to make his own death all the more inevitable. There's been some suggestion of this. There's been some suggestion that this is simply anger and indignation at the reality of death, at the sadness of the way that human beings have faced death and have had to face death for thousands of years, and it's kind of the anger of someone who's tired of seeing this very sad, very wrong thing happen and wants to see it reversed. That to me is the best angle on it, but it doesn't quite wrap up all the loose ends of it to me. But at any rate, we see a great deal of weeping, a great deal of emotion here that relates to the subject of Lazarus and to the fact that he lays dead. At least they presume that he lays dead right now in the tomb. And there's questions even now. Well, if this man opened the eyes of the blind, he could have kept this man from dying. And sure enough, that would have been a pretty interesting thing for Jesus to do as Lazarus was kind of on his deathbed, for him to bring him back from the dead, or to bring him back from a grave illness. It would be something maybe even greater than giving sight to the blind man or helping the lame man to walk. But Jesus is about to do something that surprises even the crowd. It may not be surprising to Martha, but the crowd is probably thinking at this point the limit of what Jesus could probably do is just heal somebody who is gravely ill. And so it says, again, Jesus is greatly disturbed, very emotional. If you don't catch the tone of extreme emotionalism that follows Jesus all the way through this story, you're missing an important angle of it. And we're told that he comes to the tomb. It's a cave, and there's a stone that's lying up against it. And Jesus says, "Take away the stone." And Martha, the sister of the dead man, the one who professed faith in Jesus just a moment ago, by the way, says, "Lord, there's already a stench. He's been dead for 4 days." At this point, the decomposition process, she is arguing, has begun. So how can we open the tomb? And Jesus says to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So you hear Jesus again here talking about belief to Martha, but it has to do with rolling the stone away from the cave. Now, what is the connection between the action of rolling the stone away and the belief that Martha had? Well, I think if we're just talking about intellectual assent, oh yeah, I agree with the proposition that you are the Messiah, I don't think whether the stone gets rolled away or not is terribly significant to that belief. But if belief has to do with being immersed in, with understanding this new reality, and with then acting in a way that is consistent with your understanding of that new reality, then opening that stone, removing that stone from the tomb has everything to do with belief. Because if she understands that there's this reality now where God can raise the dead, if that's truly who she is and the way she perceives the world, then sure, she's going to move that stone because she knows that God's glory is waiting behind it in the tomb. So, it says they take away the stone. And it says that Jesus looks upward and he says, "Father, I thank you for having heard me." Is this an indication, perhaps, that there is no odor coming from the tomb, that Jesus already sees the indication, the physical indication, or rather smells the physical indication that the decomposition process has not begun as the objection indicated? Is that how he knows that God has already heard him? I don't know, but he says, "I thank you for already hearing me. I knew that you always hear me, but I say that for the sake of the crowd standing here so that they can believe that you sent me." Jesus here gives credit to God for what is about to happen so that they will, through him, see the glory of God in the resurrection. And then the rest of the story is so well known. Jesus cries with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out," and somewhat, almost anticlimactically, we just get a few words that says the dead man came out. Not a great, long, dramatic description. It just says, yeah, and then he came out. His hands and his feet, it says, are bound with strips of cloth, and his face, it says, is wrapped in a cloth. Now, this is, there's some real significance here that he still has his grave clothes on. Because later, we will have, of course, the story of the resurrection of Jesus. And in that story, when people go into a cave, just like this one, to look for Jesus, what they discover is not only that he's been raised from the dead, but that his grave clothes have been left behind. And there's a very important clue here into the nature of the differences between the resurrection of Lazarus and the resurrection of Jesus. When Lazarus comes out of the tomb, he is still bound in his grave clothes. Death is still something that binds him in some sense, even though God has raised him from the dead, or at least resuscitated him from the dead in another sense. But when Jesus is raised, death no longer has a grip on him at all. The clothes are left behind in the tomb. There's no indication that death is any longer going to have any way of conquering him. And so this resurrection that Jesus has, and this promise of a resurrection that Christians believe in, is a promise of a resurrection that's not merely a resuscitation. I know that sounds very light, a mere resuscitation of someone from the dead. But in the grand scope of things, it really is. It's not merely a resuscitation of someone from the dead, such as what we see here with Lazarus, but it is a true breaking of the bonds of death so that death no longer has its grip over this new resurrected body. Last note, Jesus says to the people, "Unbind him and let him go." Here we have Jesus again freeing someone, right? Unbinding someone and setting them free. We saw this theme begin to develop back in chapter 8 with the woman who had been caught or allegedly caught in the act of adultery. Jesus tells her she's free to go at the end of that story, and here again, Lazarus is unbound from his grave clothes and he's let go. Jesus is the person who shows mercy, who brings healing, and then who sets people free. In the next episode, we are going to cover the very last part of chapter 11. The last part of chapter 11 really flows pretty naturally from the first part of it, and so I hesitated a little bit about doing this, but I finally decided that it would be worthwhile to talk about it because there's something very important that there's a couple of things really that are very important that happen in this section that I want to make sure we give plenty of attention to those things. So next time we'll just be covering the very last part of chapter 11, and not even that. It'll really just be verses 45 to about 54. May not even make a full episode in it. We may have to create something called a mini-sode or something like that to cover text that this small. But at any rate, be ready for that in the next episode. In the meantime, I want to one more time remind everybody, if you're on Podomatic, be sure and go and subscribe to the new RSS feed from the website. If you are listening to us through iTunes, you need to make sure that you are listening to us through our new feed. There are two iTunes feeds that are available for this podcast. One of them will no longer contain further episodes of the podcast, and the other one will continue to contain those episodes in the future. So make sure that if you're subscribed to the old feed, you're resubscribing to the new feed from here on out. If you have any questions or comments, or you want to talk about this puzzling issue in the center of chapter 11, please feel free to send those to me. You can do that by email to synchronicity.podcast@gmail.com, or you can leave a comment on the website. You can send it either by audio, or you can send a regular text email, and I'll be happy either way to respond to your questions, possibly even respond to them on the air. Well, that about wraps things up for this episode of the Synchronicity Podcast. Thanks again to Q Music and Peace Love Production for providing the music that's used in this podcast. Until next time, grace and peace to everyone.